From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Welcome to Washington Watch, your beacon of truth, navigating today's complex headlines. Well, armed with insights, analysis, and interviews, all from a biblical perspective, we embark on a journey together over the next hour. So join us as we delve beyond the noise, engaging with national leaders and newsmakers to uncover the truth that matters most to you and your family. I'm your host, Tony Perkins, and Washington Watch starts now.
I can confirm that Hamas has issued a response. We are reviewing that response now and discussing it with our partners in the region as to what's in their response, what it looks like. We're going to review that and withhold judgment until we've had a chance to conduct a full review.
That was State Department spokesman Matthew Miller earlier today after Hamas said it accepted the Egyptian-Qatari ceasefire proposal. It is unclear if the terms are acceptable to Israel. One Israeli official speaking on conditions of anonymity said the terms of the deal were insufficient and the effort was, quote, a ruse intended to make Israel look like the side refusing the deal, end quote. We're going to talk with Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton in just a moment. Additionally, reports surfaced over the weekend that the Biden administration was blocking the shipment of arms to Israel. Now, that's after the Congress authorized additional funding for Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan. We're going to talk about that as well. And an investigative report into who is funding the anti-Israeli protest on university campuses suggests that it is some of the same people who are funding Joe Biden and his campaign. Cheryl Chumley with the Washington Times joins me a little later. Today marked the Holocaust Martyrs and Heroes Remembrance Day that memorializes the 6 million Jews murdered in the Holocaust.
80 years ago, in the Holocaust, the Jewish people were totally defenseless against those who sought our destruction. No nation came to our aid. Today, we again confront enemies bent on our destruction. I say to the leaders of the world, no amount of pressure, no decision by any international forum will stop Israel from defending itself.
That was Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Well, here in the U.S., some are claiming that the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act that passed the House last week is an attack on free speech and the gospel. We're going to explore those claims with David Bernstein, Distinguished University Professor Chair at George Mason University's Antonin Scalia Law School. And finally, a community in Louisiana is garnering international attention. After a 10-year court battle, the citizens of St. George in East Baton Rouge Parish, which happens to be my home parish or county, got the green light a little over a week ago to form their own city so that they could create community schools. Well, guess what the opponents of the new city claim? We're going to talk about it with Andrew Merle, one of the leaders of the effort, later here on Washington Watch. Well, earlier today, a Hamas leader said in a social media post that his organization has agreed to a ceasefire in Gaza. But Israeli officials counter this claim, saying the terrorist group had not agreed to the latest terms of Israel's proposal. Now, this comes as Israel warns civilians to evacuate a section of the city of Rafah in advance of a military incursion. And just a day after Hamas killed 4 Israeli soldiers with rocket fire. Joining me now to discuss the latest on this pending agreement, as well as the report that the Biden administration is blocking arms to Israel, is Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas. He serves on the Senate Judiciary Committee and the Senate Armed Services Committee. He joins us by phone. Senator Cotton, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hey, Tony. It's good to be back on with you.
Well, Senator, there are conflicting claims about the ceasefire. What do we currently know?
Tony, what it appears to be is yet another info operation by Hamas, another effort to win the PR battle since they know they can't win a military battle. Unfortunately, Joe Biden and Democrats and gullible liberals all across the world have too often fallen for Hamas's PR info operations. Hamas said today, as Israeli troops were beginning the push into the city of Rafah, that they had agreed to a ceasefire deal. But apparently it was a deal that Israel never agreed to, certainly with terms that Israel found unacceptable. The one term that Hamas insists upon is that Hamas gets to continue to operate and control Gaza. And there's widespread agreement inside of Israel, understandably so, after the October 7th atrocities, that Hamas must be destroyed. Unfortunately, what you see over the last 3 weeks is that as Israel began the push towards Rafah the last time, Hamas was ready to finally sit down and negotiate a deal to release some, if not all, hostages. But they became gradually more stubborn over the last 3 weeks as Joe Biden yet again began to put more pressure on Israel, you know, threatening to withhold ammunition, which they apparently finally did last week, and condemning Israel's intention to go into Rafah. Hamas can see all this, and they know that if they just hold their what they've got and don't agree to any kind of ceasefire that involves concessions on their side, Joe Biden may still give them what they want. So where is Hamas's incentive to release any of these hostages? As long as Joe Biden is putting more pressure on Israel than he is on Hamas, they don't have much incentive.
Senator, do you agree with one Israeli official speaking on the conditions of anonymity, said that the this may just be another ruse by Hamas to try to make it look like Israel is the one that's not willing to actually come to terms with a ceasefire?
Yeah, very much so. Hamas, again, knows that it can't win a military battle against Israel, so it's trying to win the battle of political spin, and it wants to blame Israel, and it knows that Joe Biden and European leaders are always apt to blame Israel more than they are to blame Hamas. So with Israel poised to enter Rafah to destroy the final four remaining Hamas battalions, Hamas is, again, trying to win the war of spin to make it look like Israel is to blame, when in reality, none of this would be happening if Hamas had not committed the worst atrocity against Jews since World War II. And it could all end today, very simply, if Hamas would release all the hostages and surrender unconditionally. That's what happened to losers in war, and Hamas started a war that it cannot possibly win militarily.
So where's the international outcry for that, for them to release the hostages that they're continuing to hold 7 months later?
That's a very good question, Tony, and you don't hear much of it, and to include from Joe Biden and the Democratic Party. They, again, put more pressure on Israel than they do on Hamas. And that's in part, Tony, because of what you see in campuses all across America, these little Gazas full of pro-Hamas sympathizers and fanatics. They may be a very small minority of the American people, but they have an outside voice in the Democratic Party. Again, if all of the fanatics in these little Gazas wanted an end to suffering in Gaza, they would be calling for Hamas to release the hostages and to surrender unconditionally. So the people of Gaza would no longer be suffering due to Hamas's abuse of them.
Senator, I know you've been very outspoken on what's been happening on these college campuses. You've also been around quite some time. You're Army veteran. You've served in the Congress. You know that historically support for Israel has been a bipartisan issue. That's changed really here just in the last decade to where we're at this point now. But do you think these university students that are in, as you describe, these little Gazas, do they even know what they're talking about? Do they know what they're protesting?
Tony, many of these fanatics couldn't even pick out Gaza on a map, or they couldn't even tell you which river the so-called West Bank is on the bank of. All they know is that after being indoctrinated and marinating in Marxist nonsense from their Marxist professors who are out there trying to protect them at places like Columbia and North Carolina, is that somehow in their warped moral mindset, Israel has become oppressive colonialists, and Arabs living in Gaza and Judea and Samaria are somehow, you know, the winners of the DEI lottery because they are being oppressed. These are the same people, oftentimes funded by the same foundations who were out during the BLM riots in 2020. But they're not, of course, highly informed about what's going on in Gaza right now. And again, If they wanted to stop suffering inside of Gaza, which is certainly happening because of Hamas's misrule, they would be demanding that Hamas unconditionally surrender, just like Germany's de facto government did in May of 1945 after Hitler committed suicide and with some parts of their territory still not under Allied control, just like Japan did in August of 1945 after we dropped two nuclear bombs on them. That's what Hamas could do now if it cared about its own people. But that's the catch. Hamas does not care about the people of Gaza. It only cares about its own power and its own murderous ideology.
Senator, you sit on the Armed Services Committee in the Senate. You track these international moves. You know the volatility of the world right now. For Israel to fight to a draw because of international pressure, does that not make them vulnerable to even strong? I mean, Hamas isn't really, as you've pointed out, Hamas isn't even a challenge. It's just the international community has really tied Israel's hands behind their back. The greater threat, Hezbollah and Iran. If they fight to a draw there, doesn't that make them more vulnerable?
Yeah, there will only be winners and losers in this war, Tony. There will not be a draw. It's very simple. If Hamas survives as a governing authority inside of Gaza, it wins and Israel loses. If it doesn't, Israel wins. Now, I know some of the so-called sophisticates out there on the left in the administration say, well, you know, Hamas is an ideology and an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, and the ideology can't be destroyed. It's like, okay, I take the point, but you know what you can destroy is all of the leaders of Hamas. Right. And all of its soldiers and all of its infrastructure, just like we did to the Islamic State under President Trump. And yes, there are still people who subscribe to the Islamic State or Hamas's hateful ideology, but they don't control territory the size of Indiana anymore. That's what Israel can do. And as you say, what it must do, otherwise the message that not only Hamas will get, but Hezbollah and Iran is we can attack Israel and we can wait out their counterattacks and count on Democrats and Europeans to put enough pressure on Israel that they will ultimately stand down. If Israel destroys Hamas, they will get the opposite lesson. And all those Arab nations who have been quietly or in some cases openly helping Israel will see we bet on the right horse here.
Right.
Israel
right.
is tough and strong and will defend itself, and therefore they will help us defend ourselves against
right.
Iran and these terror groups.
Right. Extremely important point. Senator, last question for you. The Congress passed, the House, the Senate passed funding, additional funding for Israel, along with Ukraine, Taiwan. Reports that the Biden administration actually blocked the much-needed shipments of ammunition to Israel. What do we know about that?
So we're trying to get to the bottom of it, Tony. You may have seen John Kirby from the National Security Council today, him and Hahn refused to confirm or deny those reports, which leads me to believe they very well may be true. If so, it may be the worst foreign policy blunder yet of this president's failed tenure, even worse than the withdrawal from Afghanistan, because while it's bad enough to try to verbally or rhetorically restrain Israel, it's much worse to deny it the ammunition it needs in the middle of a shooting war
right.
of its own survival.
Right.
And if they are denying Israel with ammunition resupply, they are most surely signaling that to Hamas as well, which again just encourages Hamas to dig in and wait out Israel and not release a single hostage.
Right. And they need the resupply after the attack by Iran to resupply the Iron Dome and David Sling. Senator Cotton, always great to talk with you. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tony.
All right, folks, stick with us. We're back with more Washington Watch after the break.
Christians must be sure to faithfully think about the issues that have taken our culture and many of our churches by storm from a biblical perspective. Family Research Council's David Clawson, along with co-authors Denny Burke and Colin Smothers, released a new book, Male and Female, He Created Them, a study on gender, sexuality, and marriage to help Christians better grasp the Bible's teaching about these issues. This study presents a biblical view of homosexuality, transgenderism, and marriage. With this new resource, readers will be given guidance on specific specific questions related to preferred pronouns, identity, intersex conditions, and other matters that our churches must be discipling their members to respond to with love and biblical conviction. As part of the study, readers have access to supplemental videos by Dr. Albert Moeller, Dr. Heath Lambert, Reverend H.B. Charles, Dr. Christopher Yuan, Dr. Rosaria Butterfield, and others that expand and elaborate the themes of each chapter. To purchase a copy, go to hecreatedthem.org.
Today we find that global persecutions of Christians is growing more menacing every year. Family Research Council's Leila Gilbert, Ariel Del Turco, and Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin's book, Heroic Faith, shares personal stories from those who have endured religious persecution and gives a close look at the dire situations Christians often face due to dangerous and sometimes deadly opposition to their faith. The book's true stories of persistence and faithfulness amidst crisis offer inspiration and hope. Heroic Faith also provides insights into the ideologies driving the hostility and persecution, what steps the U.S. government might take to help, and how readers can best respond to the struggles of the faithful. It is critical for us to learn from our brothers and sisters who are suffering deeply and to do whatever we can to help. You can get your copy of Heroic Faith wherever books are sold or by going to frc.org/heroicfaith. Again, that's frc.org/heroicfaith. Men are constantly told that there is no place for their thoughts and concerns about abortion. However, this attitude ignores the fact that both women and men are deeply and personally affected by abortion. Furthermore, one does not have to be a woman to know that abortion ends the life of an innocent, unborn child. Every man has a role to play in protecting unborn lives and supporting the mothers in their families and greater community, which is why FRC's Center for Human Dignity has released a resource titled A Man's Guide to Standing for Life. This resource was created to help men positively address the topic of life. This guide will equip men with phrases to utilize or avoid, as well as practical tips for helping to protect life and the expectant mother or unborn child he knows. Every man has the opportunity to be an unborn baby's hero by stepping in to support a mother and speaking up for her child's life. Get this free guide at frc.org/prolifemen to learn more about the important role men play in protecting unborn lives.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. By the way, join us May the 19th for a Pray For and Stand With Israel Sunday. To find out more about that, text Israel to 67742. That's Israel to 67742. All right, a little over a week ago, after a 10-year court battle, the Louisiana Supreme Court ruled in favor of the proposed city of St. George, allowing a local community to separate from the city of Baton Rouge. They're actually in the city, in the parish, but they can create their own city. They can take control of their own streets and create their own schools, which is really the genesis for this. And I know a little bit about this because I was a part of creating the independent schools for another city in East Baton Rouge about 25 years ago. And in fact, the city I live in was created for the same reason, to give local control. Well, there's been fierce opposition from Baton Rouge to keep this community's tax base, because it's a very affluent area. But the court ruled that the organizers followed the proper process. Imagine that, following the law. They followed the process for incorporation, and they would be able to provide for its residents with the proper public services. But yet the opponents are still screaming. Joining me now to discuss this is Andrew Merle. He is the spokesman for the city of St. George. He helped provide the leadership to the effort. Andrew, welcome to Washington Watch.
Oh, thanks for having me, Tony.
So I know, as I mentioned, a little bit about this process, gone through it back when I was in the state legislature. The opponents are saying this is racist. Why?
Clickbait, Tony. That's as simple as that. It's a divisive comment that once made creates passion and anger. And unfortunately, it's not true, but it's used by the opposition to create that division so people will quit looking beyond that word and to looking deeper into the real issues.
So this has garnered international attention because of that, as you say, described as clickbait. But the reality is, and this is my parish. I live in East Baton Rouge Parish. I know it quite well. I've held office in East Baton Rouge Parish. East Baton Rouge Parish is having an exodus of citizens and people leaving the community. This actually would help the entire parish.
Well, two things to note. Number one, the census says otherwise. We're the fastest growing minority population in the parish, is in the St. George area. And you're exactly right. Our citizens have been voting for decades now with their feet and moving to the outlying parishes. And while they're booming, we're declining.
And why is it? Why are they leaving?
Well, I mean, simple reasons, the things people don't want to look into. High crime, poor education, one of the worst education systems in a country ranked near the bottom, and no opportunity. They're leaving, they're taking their businesses, their tax dollars, their families, and their futures to other places.
You've pointed out in your defense of the citizens of St. George to do this that the parts of the parish that are prospering are what parts?
Well, the parts that have done exactly what we've done. They form their own cities. Ultimately, they form their own school districts. And now those same areas are enjoying top five school districts in the state, while the East Baton Rouge system, again, ranks near the bottom.
But when you have a community like Central, community I live in, Zachary, which is another one in East Baton Rouge Parish, and now St. George, part of that tax base still goes to the parish.
Well, and that's another misnomer from the opposition, that we're taking our money and going elsewhere. But we're not leaving. We're all trying to stay here. We don't want to leave, and we're fighting for the right to stay here. So, yes, the tax dollars, your property taxes, for example, in the city of St. George will continue to benefit East Baton Rouge Parish for decades. And where you live, in fact, has grown their tax base to the point where the parish is making more money off the city of Central now than it ever did when it was unincorporated.
Is this an example, Andrew, of people wanting government closer to them so they can help make decisions and shape what their streets look like, what their schools look like? I mean, isn't that the basic part of having representative government?
Well, absolutely. Accountable to you, the citizen, you, the taxpayer. Your tax dollars actually going back to benefit you. It's a novel concept. Seems to be an exception these days.
So, Andrew, what are the next steps?
So the next steps for us, we have one more rehearing with the Louisiana Supreme Court. Once we win that hearing, the governor is going to appoint an interim mayor and city council, and then we will start collecting that tax revenue. And whether you're for us or against us, come to the table, and the next year we're going to start creating the foundation for St. George.
So give us kind of a timeline of what that looks like from here.
Well, at this point, we have a transition district that's sole purpose is to transfer some of those services from Baton Rouge to the city of St. George. That group will begin their work, and over the next year, you'll see the master plan for the community coming into place. Planning, permitting, and zoning will be created to, again, be accountable directly to the citizens of St. George with their own representatives.
So have the officials in East Baton Rouge Parish kind of come to terms with this, realizing that this is the future and that they need to work with the city of St. George?
No. No, we've never, as many times as we've reached out to have what I would say an amicable conversation, we have never had a polite or friendly conversation with them at this point. They've refused to have it.
But the response from the citizens in this new city in St. George has been overwhelming multiple times. I mean, the citizens voted on this. This wasn't just a group of people that decided this. The citizens voted on it. The citizens have been pushing and funding this effort to defend it in court.
That's right. Over 17,000 people showed up at an election with a 60% voter turnout and voted in favor of incorporating St. George. And over 4 years later, we're still fighting in court for that right. We're still fighting for the right to vote.
And so bottom line, who's been fighting you the whole time?
Well, we have the mayor to blame. She's a member of the lawsuit. But there's also members of the Baton Rouge aristocracy. They want to maintain their grip and control over Baton Rouge. They like how things have been going. It benefits them. And now someone's challenging that status quo, and they're unhappy about it.
Well, Andrew, what I think this is, as I've seen it before, is citizens getting involved. It brings them into the process. It gives them a stake in the process. Schools improve. The business community improves, and over time, and we've had the city of Central about 20 years, as you pointed out, the tax base for the entire parish grows. So this is what really elected officials should embrace.
You would think so. The right to vote, the right to self-govern, the right for self-determination, all fundamental principles that we should embrace and I'd hope protect, and they're challenging. Exactly.
Andrew, I want to thank you for joining us, and congratulations on sticking with this and seeing it all the way through to success.
Well, thank you for giving us a voice. I appreciate it.
Exactly. And folks, this is what we're encouraging people to get involved. This, I believe, is really the hope of our country, is that we begin to grab the authority and the power that is invested in us as citizens to make a difference right where we live. You know, we may not be able to change Washington. We may not be able to change, you know, the capital, the state capital, but we can certainly start right in our own community. All right, don't go away. When we come back, we're going to look at who's funding these university protests. That's next on Washington Watch. Don't go away.
Christians must be sure to faithfully think about the issues that have taken our culture and many of our churches by storm from a biblical perspective. Family Research Council's David Clawson, along with co-authors Denny Burke and Colin Smothers, released a new book, Male and Female, He Created Them, a study on gender, sexuality, and marriage to help Christians better grasp the Bible's teaching about these issues. This study presents a biblical view of homosexuality, transgenderism, and marriage. With this new resource, readers will be given guidance on specific questions related to preferred pronouns, identity, intersex conditions, and other matters that our churches must be discipling their members to respond to with love and biblical conviction. As part of the study, readers have access to supplemental videos by Dr. Albert Moeller, Dr. Heath Lambert, Reverend H.B. Charles, Dr. Christopher Yuan, Dr. Rosaria Butterfield, and others that expand and elaborate the themes of each chapter. To purchase a copy, go to hecreatedthem.org.
Today we find that global persecutions of Christians is growing more menacing every year. Family Research Council's Leela Gilbert, Ariel Del Turco, and Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin's book, Heroic Faith, shares personal stories from those who have endured religious persecution and gives a close look at the dire situations Christians often face due to dangerous and sometimes deadly opposition to their faith. The book's true stories of persistence and faithfulness amidst crisis offer inspiration and hope. Heroic Faith also provides insights into the ideologies driving the hostility and persecution, what steps the U.S. government might take to help, and how readers can best respond to the struggles of the faithful. It is critical for us to learn from our brothers and sisters who are suffering deeply and to do whatever we can to help. You can get your copy of Heroic Faith wherever books are sold or by going to frc.org/heroicfaith. Again, that's frc.org/heroicfaith.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Good to have you with us on this Monday. All right, as pro-Hamas demonstrations have roiled college campuses throughout the country, many have noted the protest demonstrations, they kind of all look the same. They have all these indicators of a well-funded, highly coordinated effort. Imagine that. Well, recent reporting has revealed that student groups organizing the protest have received financial backing from many of the largest funders of Democratic election campaigns, including top donors of President Joe Biden's reelection bid. Now, given the president's catering support among young people who are anti-Israel, what can we make of these conflicting agendas? Well, joining me now to discuss this is Washington Times online opinion editor and columnist Cheryl Chumley. Cheryl, welcome to Washington Watch. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Great to be with you.
So you've covered the funding sources for these student demonstrations. What have you learned?
So a lot of people have kept their eyes on how the funding is flowing into some of these student groups. And really, it's your usual suspects, right? George Soros' Open Society Foundation, the Tides Foundation, the Rockefeller Brothers Fund. Formerly, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation had some ties to this, too, though they've said that they pulled out of funding in certain groups that are now funding these pro-Palestinian anti-Israel protests. The Pritzkers, Susan and Nick Pritzker, they are the heirs of the Hyatt Hotel chain, and they not only have their hands in this funding of these groups, but have donated to Joe Biden's campaign just a couple years ago to the tune of $300,000. So if you start looking at some of these curious ties, there really does seem to be very many links between the funders of these anti-Semitic displays and the Democrat Party.
Now, I saw a poll from Harvard recently that suggested from 18 to 29-year-olds, this poll, I think it was out like 2 weeks ago, it was among Americans under 30, they had a list of about 16 issues. Almost dead last of the issues was the Israel-Hamas conflict. So I'm wondering, given the financial backing and the polling on this, are these demonstrations more astroturf than grassroots?
Well, there's always a mix, right? And speaking of polls, there was an even more alarming poll that came out just recently that showed that Gen Zers, 18 to 24-year-olds, a third of them actually don't think Israel has a right to exist as a Jewish nation. So that's a little bit of alarming warning what's coming down the pike in terms of America's next batch of leaders. But if you're looking at whether these protests are just springing up based on student concerns for the poor Palestinian civilians, then I would have to disagree with that. I would have to say that it appears to me that this is yet another leftist-type strategy to take advantage of the ignorance of youth that have been purposely dumbed down by Democrats in the public school system for years. And now they are using these youthful protesters on college campuses to advance a political agenda that is very anti-Semitic at root.
Well, it also works to garner media attention. So, I mean, this has dominated the media for 2 weeks. So, I mean, if you're thinking about, you know, from a political standpoint, you want to get your messaging out there. I mean, you pay, you know, a few million dollars to buy pizza for kids and give them, you know, worksheets on how to have a protest. And then you have the media covering it, you know, wall to wall for 2.5 weeks. It's actually a pretty good investment of your money.
It actually is. That's a very good point. And look, if you step back from what's going on in the college campuses, that's one issue. The ugly, horrific protest movements that I never thought I would see so widespread in America, right? But the bigger theme here, the bigger issue that we need to concern ourselves with is why this is taking place. And it's not so much about Israel, an anti-Israel agenda, which is part and parcel of it. But the bigger idea is to tear down America, to divide and conquer, which is sort of the Democrat Party playbook that we've seen since Barack Obama days, since the Democrat Party took a turn from being, you know, the pro-America blue-collar working party to really one that is filled with Marxists and communists and collectivists, right, and those who hate America. And one way that they can tear down America from within is to create chaos, division, and violent outbursts.
Yeah, this is right out of the Marxist playbook. So, Cheryl, takeaway, primary takeaway for this last 30 seconds, how do Americans need to respond to this?
Well, first off, if you're a parent with a child who wants to go to college, I would think very, very carefully about that. And second off, it's really time to turn back to God in this nation, because we are fighting so many battles on the political realm right now. And if we see these youth as emerging to be America's next leaders, we are in deep, deep trouble, and we need God more than ever.
Cheryl, extremely well said. I agree 100% with you. Thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you for what you do.
Thank you. Thanks.
All right, Cheryl Chumley with the Washington Times. You can find out more by going to TonyPerkins.com, and she is absolutely right. While these things are playing out in the political realm, they are spiritual at their heart. And America needs to return to God. And that means each of our homes. As parents, we need to teach our children who God is, what He has done, and what He requires of us. It all begins in the home. All right, after the break, there's been a lot of criticism from the right and left over the House's anti-Semitism awareness bill. We're going to break it down after the break. Don't go away. More Washington Watch straight ahead.
Thank you.
Christians must be sure to faithfully think about the issues that have taken our culture and many of our churches by storm from a biblical perspective. Family Research Council's David Clawson, along with co-authors Denny Burke and Colin Smothers, released a new book, Male and Female, He Created Them, a study on gender, sexuality, and marriage to help Christians better grasp the Bible's teaching about these issues. This study presents a biblical view of homosexuality, transgenderism, and marriage. With this new resource, readers will be given guidance on specific questions related to preferred pronouns, identity, intersex conditions, and other matters that our churches must be discipling their members to respond to with love and biblical conviction. As part of the study, readers have access to supplemental videos by Dr. Albert Moeller, Dr. Heath Lambert, Reverend H.B. Charles, Dr. Christopher Yuan, Dr. Rosaria Butterfield, and others that expand and elaborate the themes of each chapter. To purchase a copy, go to hecreatedthem.org.
Today we find that global persecutions of Christians is growing more menacing every year. Family Research Council's Lila Gilbert, Ariel Del Turco, and Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin's book, Heroic Faith, shares personal stories from those who have endured religious persecution and gives a close look at the dire situations Christians often face due to dangerous and sometimes deadly opposition to their faith. The book's true stories of persistence and faithfulness amidst crisis offer inspiration and hope. Heroic Faith also provides insights into the ideologies driving the hostility and persecution, what steps the U.S. government might take to help, and how readers can best respond to the struggles of the faithful. It is critical for us to learn from our brothers and sisters who are suffering deeply and to do whatever we can to help. You can get your copy of Heroic Faith wherever books are sold or by going to frc.org/heroicfaith. Again, that's frc.org/heroicfaith. Men are constantly told that there is no place for their thoughts and concerns about abortion. However, this attitude ignores the fact that both women and men are deeply and personally affected by abortion. Furthermore, one does not have to be a woman to know that abortion ends the life of an innocent, unborn child. Every man has a role to play in protecting unborn lives and supporting the mothers in their families and greater community, which is why FRC's Center for Human Dignity has released a resource titled A Man's Guide to Standing for Life. This resource was created to help men positively address the topic of life. This guide will equip men with phrases to utilize or avoid, as well as practical tips for helping to protect life and the expectant mother or unborn child he knows. Every man has the opportunity to be an unborn baby's hero by stepping in to support a mother and speaking up for her child's life. Get this free guide at frc.org/prolifemen to learn more about the important role men play in protecting unborn lives.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Good to have you with us on this Monday. If you'd like to join us on May the 19th for our Pray For and Stand With Israel Sunday, churches across the nation will simply be praying for Israel, letting Israel and the world know that we are standing with them in this time of need. To join us, text the word Israel to 67742. That's Israel to 67742, or you can go to TonyPerkins.com. Our word for today comes from Judges chapter 16. Afterward, it happened that he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah. And the lords of the Philistines came up to her and said to her, "Entice him and find out where his great strength lies, and by what means we may overpower him, that we may bind him to afflict him. And every one of us will give you 1,100 pieces of silver." Delilah said to Samson, "Please tell me where your great strength lies and with what you may be bound with to afflict you." Now, this happened three times. You would think one episode of this should be enough to alert Samson to her intentions. But this happened, as I said, three times. Had he become complacent with the power he had been given by God, thinking it was his and nothing could separate him from his strength? You know, we must constantly remind ourselves that God's gifts cannot be enjoyed apart from God's presence. For more on our journey through the Bible, text Bible to 67742. That's Bible to 67742. Well, after the House overwhelmingly passed the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act last week, it was not surprising to see many on the left attack the bill, given the anti-Semitic rhetoric and violence we've seen on college campuses since October the 7th. But the legislation has also drawn conservative critics as well. Some have claimed that the bill violates the First Amendment, threatening free speech. Even more concerning is that there are suggestions that this legislation would make the message of the gospel illegal. What's behind these accusations? This is not the first time we've seen this language. In fact, President Donald Trump in December of 2019 actually put forward this same language as an executive order across the entire federal government. Well, breaking this down with us today is David Bernstein. He's a professor at the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University and recently published an article at National Review Online with the headline, What People Are Getting Wrong About the House Anti-Semitism Bill. Professor, welcome to Washington Watch. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So describe the text of this legislation, what it would do and what it would not do.
Well, the first thing, which is the most important thing about the law, is that it would ensure that Jews are protected from discrimination on campus. When Congress passed the 64 Civil Rights Act, it excluded religion from protections to protect religious schools. And until the Bush administration, the position of the government was that Jews are religious groups that are not protected. But since then, every administration has agreed that Jews are protected as an ethnic group from ethnic discrimination, and this law would codify that, make it into the law. So that's the uncontroversial part. The controversial part is that it says that when a Jewish student sues for a university for discrimination, when determining whether the discrimination in question was that's alleged was in fact discrimination, whether it was just a coincidence or something else happened, that the Office of Civil Rights may use a definition called the International Holocaust Remembrance Line's definition of anti-Semitism in determining whether someone was engaged in discriminatory intent. And one example that is given in the definition is that traditional Christian doctrine that has been used for anti-Semitic purposes, if it's used to being criticized, if it's being used to criticize Israel, may be anti-Semitic. And it's that's all it says. That's exactly what everyone's already doing. It just makes it into the law. And let me give you an example of what sort of thing this would actually affect. Imagine someone says, you know, it's no wonder the Jews are murdering Palestinians left and right. After all, they killed Christ, right? I don't think anyone would doubt that that might very well be an anti-Semitic statement. It doesn't ban people from preaching the gospel. It doesn't even ban people from saying Jews killed Jesus. It doesn't ban people from criticizing Israel however they want. It only says that if we're trying to determine whether someone made an action that looks like it was discriminatory, if they also were making statements at the same time, those statements might be usable for discriminatory intent.
Well, I may get to that in a moment from a theological standpoint, but I want to step back for just a moment. This is the identical language that was in the executive order that was promulgated by President Trump. It makes reference to this international standard that about 1,000 different government entities actually use. So this is not like it's a new definition of anti-Semitism. And the example that you just used is about one of 15 that the International Holocaust Remembrance Association puts forth. So this is not new. Am I correct?
You're absolutely correct. And for those of your viewers who've seen people alleging crazy things like you won't be able to read the Bible, it's going to make the New Testament illegal, you're not going to be able to talk about Jesus's death, this is already the rule. This is already applied in the federal government, in the educational context, in 30 states, in most of the major cities in the United States. All it does is take a rule that's already has been implemented throughout the United States and applies it. It says, okay, we're not just implementing this from an administrative point of view, which could be reversed at any time, or making it part of the law. So it's really, if you're able to, whatever you're able to do right now, whatever you're legally able to do, you will still be able to do it if this law passes.
Professor, one other place it's been utilized, the State Department has actually had this definition, I think, since 2016, if I'm not mistaken. But let me ask you this question, Professor. Have there been any cases since this definition has been utilized where we've seen someone that has been making reference to the gospel or someone's free speech has been violated?
There are certainly no cases involving the gospel. I think one background thing we should understand is that, unlike in the United States, in Europe, it's been very common to do things like around Christmas time, have cartoons that say they killed him with a capital H and now they're killing them, and show like a bloodthirsty Israeli murdering a Palestinian child.
Let me stop you there, because that's a reference to modern day Israel.
Yes.
What this applies to. This does not apply to the reading of the scripture that you would say that the— and I'm going to get here into the theological in a moment, but to say the Jews in the Bible were responsible for the death of Christ, that is not what is covered under this provision, under this definition.
No, it's very specifically about using things that happened or thought to have happened, or some people believe happened 2,000 years ago, to criticize the state of
the
Israel.
The modern
or Israel
state of
today.
Israel. Right.
Right.
So from a theological standpoint, as a Bible-believing Christian, the way we see this is that Jesus Christ his life wasn't taken from him. He laid down his life, but his life was given for the sins of all mankind. And so we are the ones responsible for his death. Our sins was what required his death and sacrificial death on the cross. So that is a biblical holding of what happened in Scripture. That is, history has shown us, though, that there are those who have an anti-Semitic, I don't want to say leaning, but drive, try to blame the Jewish people for the death of Christ. And that is,
yes,
when it's coming from a place of anti-Semitism, that's what this is talking about.
Yes, but I just wanted to caution that even then, this bill does not— I mean, obviously I'm not I'm Jewish, so I'm not going to get into inter-Christian debates about the New Testament. But even if someone took the most anti-Semitic possible reading of the Gospels and preached that in his church, this law does not threaten his or her ability to do that. It's only if they engage in some other anti-Semitic action, like they run a large business, they happen to be a Christian, and they denied someone a job, and that person says, well, you know, of course I wouldn't hire that guy, he's a Christ killer. Yes, that's a reference to something in the New Testament, but that could be used, not the statement that you think Jews are Christ killers, that's lawful, but if the question is, did you not hire this person because he was Jewish, or is it just that there were better employees, the fact that you called him a Christ killer would be evidence of discriminatory intent.
But even that itself is going to end up in court. I mean, that's what's going to end up happening with that. But this is designed to address not beliefs but actions.
Correct, and it's not a criminal law. So people who say, oh, people can go to jail for preaching the Bible, it's only for civil actions, only for evidentiary purposes. So there's been a lot of exaggeration. I'm not sure the people who are saying this have actually read the bill. I don't know what their motivations are, but I don't know if I've ever seen so much distortion over such something that's really so inconsequential, in the sense it doesn't change what's already the law, basically.
Well, Professor Bernstein, that's kind of my next question is, well, then there was no, you know, dust-up in 2019. In fact, I was the chairman of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Now, we didn't focus on U.S. Policy, but we focused internationally. And one of my last hearings that I chaired under the Trump administration was on anti-Semitism in Europe. And that was a part of this executive order that the president executed to deal with this issue in the United States across the federal government. There was no controversy. Nothing was said like what we're hearing today. So why is it a problem now that the Congress has taken action to codify the provisions of this into law.
Well, look, I'm not an expert on domestic politics, but it does seem obvious to me that there are certain media figures, I can name names if you want, but who have decided that part of their audience is the fringe right-wing anti-Semitic group. It's always been out there, but has generally, you know, for a long time, the conservative movement was very firm about keeping the people out. And there are some people who are entrepreneurial who said, you know, there's always this faction of the American right that's always been kind of suspicious of Jews, and we're going to play them to get our clicks, to get our viewers. If Fox News won't put me on, I'll just appeal to the more fringy people.
You know, I may take you beyond where you want to go, Professor, but you're a professor of law, so you can't really avoid politics. But could it also be that the landscape of America has changed in the last 4 years, where there is a lot of people don't trust government? There's no confidence that the government is going to operate from a standard of justice. And so there's this fear now that any power given to the government, we read into, and there's an element that reads the worst into it.
I think that's right. I think there's increased suspicion and paranoia. Sometimes, you know, some of it's not completely unjustified, frankly, because the government does misbehave. And, you know, there are also abuses of some of these civil rights laws where we know that there are people who have said relatively innocuous things, who then get brought up on charges on campuses or sometimes lose their jobs. And that's a fear. And that fear is not completely unreasonable for anti-Semitism as well, that people could be fired or punished unreasonably. But that's not really what this – that's a real problem with what we call hostile environment law, that hostile environment law could be used to suppress speech. But like I said, that's – this bill doesn't change the way things are right now. It doesn't add anything to what hostile environment law currently says. There are problems with overreach in enforcing some of these types of laws, but that is really not at all specific to this legislation, which doesn't really move the ball at all. It just codifies what's already in place. And I'm all in favor of reconsidering whether some of the scope of some of our civil rights laws go too far, but I'm not really in favor of saying, well, everyone, you know, we're going to single out Jews and say we can't protect Jews from anti-Semitism, but other groups do get protection from discrimination in the same context.
That said, Professor, do you see anything in the House version of legislation, which now is going, the Senate's going to take it up, and I assume may take it up this week? I've been talking to some of the sponsors over there. Is there anything that can be addressed in the present language that could address the concerns that are out there?
The only thing I can really think of is that one thing I don't think we've even mentioned in this discussion, all those 15 or so examples of anti-Semitism that are provided in the definition, the IHRA definition, they're all given as things that could, in context, be construed as anti-Semitic. In other words, they're not saying that any time anyone says something like Israel should not exist, Jews don't deserve a homeland. They're not saying that's always anti-Semitic. They're saying in context, in a particular context, you could potentially use that as evidence of discriminatory intent. So, and I have to say, some advocates on the other side who favor this also miss that nuance sometimes, and they say, well, you said it's anti-Semitic. So I think they could potentially clarify that none of these examples are definitive, and they could also clarify that no one's going to be punished. I mean, it does say that no First Amendment rights will be violated,
right,
but they could, I think, add something to the effect that no one will be punished simply for saying one of these things. It's only, again, they could, I mean, it's all in the bill, but I suppose you could make the language clearer and bolder so that it's much harder to miss and make the emphasis there.
Okay. But I
don't think the bill is really that ambiguous.
Professor,
I think it's fine.
We're going to have to leave it there. Class is over. But I want to thank you for joining us and being on Washington Watch today. Folks, I want to thank you for joining us as well. Until next time, I leave you with the words of the Apostle Paul, where he says, when you've done everything you can do, just keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action.
For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.